From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. The welfare reform bill now under consideration in the House would cut benefits to unwed teenage mothers in an attempt to discourage teenagers from getting pregnant. On today's Fresh Air, we ask, why are so many teenage girls becoming mothers? We talk with Judith Music, author of the new book Young, Poor, and Pregnant, based on her observations running community programs for teenage girls. It's been 30 years since Fontella Bass was on top of the R&B charts with Rescue Me. Now she's singing the music she performed with her mother and grandmother as a child, gospel. We'll talk with her and hear some of her new recording of gospel music. And TV critic David Bianculli previews tonight's debut of the sitcom News Radio. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Today, the House began debate of the welfare reform bill. One of the proposed provisions would prohibit cash benefits to single mothers under the age of 18 in an attempt to discourage teenage pregnancies. The bill is controversial, but most people seem to agree that poor, single teenage mothers are likely to stay trapped in the cycle of poverty. Why are so many adolescent girls becoming mothers? My guest Judith Music offers some answers in her new book, Young, Poor, and Pregnant, The Psychology of Teenage Motherhood. It's based on her observations as the first director and current vice chair of the Ounce of Prevention Fund in Illinois. The fund runs pregnancy prevention programs in communities and in schools, as well as support programs to help teenage mothers. I asked her why she thinks so many teenagers get pregnant.
Very often, people who do large-scale surveys and who don't really know these young women or who work with them say, oh, you know, a large percentage of these are unintended pregnancies. Because these young women, if they don't know you and you ask them, they know it's socially correct. Did you mean to have this baby? Oh, no, it was a total surprise. But, you know, just because something is not deliberately planned doesn't mean it isn't wanted. And over, those who work with young mothers, and obviously I include myself in that, they will tell you in their speaking, in their writing, in groups with each other, that they really do want to have a baby.
Why would they want to become a mother at such a young age?
When you look at what the developmental task of adolescence is, for all of us, no matter where we live, anywhere in the world, the task of being an adolescent is to develop more fully a sense of identity. Who am I? What can I do? Where am I going to go with my future? And if, as is true for poor young women, when you look around and there are very few models around you in terms of, say, the significant females in your life, your mother and her sisters and your sisters and perhaps your grandmother, who before you have had children as teenagers. And when you go to a school that gives you a very strong message as soon as you enter by how poorly equipped it is, how chaotic it may be, that really, we don't really care about you as a potential learner. All of these things go into the package of your identity. Who am I and what can I do? And if we have to reach out to an identity, here is motherhood. It is a valued and obvious identity. And for many young women, there is nothing else they have.
At your program for pregnant teenagers and teenage mothers, Ounce of Prevention Fund, you've had the girls keep diaries of their thoughts and their experiences. What are some of the things they've confided in their diaries about the reasons why they wanted to become mothers?
Well, a number of things have come out. One of the things that was a thread we didn't expect, Terry, was the role of sexual abuse in their young lives, even before they got to adolescence. in teaching them about sexuality. And very often, as they wrote in their diaries, in their letters, older men within their family, maybe their stepfathers or mother's boyfriends or uncles or whatever, initiated them into their sexuality in their pre-adolescent years, and they didn't know there was really anything the matter with it. And that's a thread that they themselves tie to why they became pregnant. They also very often speak about their own mothers, and that they were maybe fighting with their mother, and when they got pregnant, they and their mother reached a rapprochement. So you can see the thread in there of needing to be like your mother. And they speak about that as well a great deal. And they speak repeatedly about the men in their lives, in their diaries.
You know, you'd think that a girl watching her friends handle motherhood might be discouraged from becoming a mother because it's so hard to be very young and to be a mother and to be poor. Yet it doesn't seem to discourage girls.
Well, you know, adolescents don't learn very well vicariously. In a sense, they think, well, because I knew so-and-so who was killed while they were driving in a car fast, or so-and-so took an overdose, it won't happen to me. And that's part of kind of the adolescent mindset. And they don't see that. They think, oh, Patsy's child falls down and makes a big fuss in the mall and embarrasses her. Mine won't. But they haven't had one yet, and they can't project to what that will be like. And so they don't learn from that.
Judith Music is my guest. She's a developmental psychologist and vice chair of the Ounce of Prevention Fund, which runs pregnancy prevention and teenage parent programs in Illinois. She's also the author of the new book, Young, Poor, and Pregnant. I believe that your center actually started out as a center for victims of sexual abuse, and then it developed into a program for teenage mothers. So you must have found some kind of connection between the two.
Well, it's an indirect series of paths. When we did research on the prevalence of sexual abuse, the time it was most likely to happen was in the prepubescent years. So this is when a girl is coming into her femaleness and into her sexuality. And if sexual abuse happens at that time, that sort of teaches her that she doesn't control her own body. And in order to contracept, you have to believe you have a body that belongs to you and that you have control over. And when you control a pre-adolescent girl's body, you do control her mind. And so it affects her ability to contracept. But it also affects something that I don't think many of the people talking about policy, Terry, really understand. It affects the sense that you can have any control over your life in a variety of domains, school or work. It breeds a sense of helplessness. And that sense of helplessness is what leads girls to very often just let pregnancy happen to them, to just let go of school, and it's that sort of thing.
Do you find that girls who are sexually abused at home are more likely to engage in sex with boyfriends at an early age?
They are more likely not only to engage in sex with boyfriends at an early age, but they're more likely to have boyfriends who are not teenagers. I think one of the things that is just beginning to be understood, and we also looked at this 5 or 6 years ago, most of the fathers of teenage mothers' babies are not teenage men. They are adults. 50% and above are adult men. So girls who've been sexually abused seem to find a series of Mr. Wrongs who continue an exploitive relationship with them. And very often then with their own children.
You've spoken to so many girls who have become pregnant. What are some of the reasons they've given you for using or not using birth control?
Well, an especially interesting thing is you may ask a direct question about something like birth control. But what they will answer you may not be that direct, although sometimes they say things like, I was taking the pill, but it was making me sick. So there is some of that. There's a lot of old wives' tales about fear of it. I was afraid I'd get cancer, or it made me sick to my stomach, or my mother told me not to take it. It would ruin my body. But very often they bring up issues of chaos in their life. If you say, what happened? What was going on in your life when you got pregnant with your first child? And were you using contraceptives at that time? They may say, well, my mother had just gotten out of a drug treatment center, and we were moving from place to place, and I left my pills someplace. But what she's really telling you is her life was in chaos, and she wasn't paying attention. Or perhaps she did indirectly want to have a child at that time. So these young women know about contraceptives. They just have a variety of reasons for not using them, including the fact that they say their partners won't use condoms. And again, these young women don't feel empowered enough to make a partner use a condom.
Is it hard to convince girls that they have the power to tell their boyfriend, no matter what age he is, you have to use a condom?
It's one of the most difficult things you can possibly imagine. And you can't do it. You know, whenever I hear about people who are running self-esteem groups, as if you can say to somebody, you know, feel good about yourself. You're a great girl. That's not, you can only feel good if you can do good. And the same thing holds for being able to have the power to tell a partner that they have to use a condom. When young women begin to get their own lives on track, or if they already have them on track, and they feel a sense of direction and purpose about what they want to do with their lives, and they understand that a pregnancy will interfere with that, and they have the skills that ground them in the knowledge that they're going to be able to do what they want to do with their lives, those young women can get people, they can get their partners to use condoms.
Judith Music is my guest, and she's a developmental psychologist. She's vice chair of the Ounce of Prevention Fund, which runs pregnancy prevention and teenage parent programs in Illinois. She's also the author of the new book, Young, Poor, and Pregnant. Let's take a short break, and then we'll talk some more about teenage pregnancy. This is Fresh Air. Back with Judith Music. She's the author of the new book, Young, Poor, and Pregnant, The Psychology of Teenage Motherhood. You not only work with pregnant girls, you work with teenage mothers. What are some of the surprises you've seen teenagers face after they have the baby, things that they weren't prepared for?
I think they were prepared for very little other than very often, especially a younger teenager, let's say, a 15 or 16-year-old. After the showers are over, the baby showers, and after the baby is a little bit bigger and becomes not just a lap baby anymore, but an assertive toddler who says no and wants its their own way. They're not prepared for that. And they very often misinterpret it as the child not liking them. This is a time when many girls, if a new skill hasn't changed their mind about what their future is, and if they have a baby who's now a toddler, and they don't have any reason not to have another, and maybe they have a new boyfriend, they become pregnant again.
But to have another compliant infant.
That's right. They have another sweet baby that you can take around, and everybody says how cute that baby is and how cute You've dressed the baby. So they're not prepared for that. They are not prepared to be selfless, which is what is required for the mothering of a helpless young child. They're not prepared for the relentlessness of being on call and not being able to be free in the way that they were before. They're not prepared for being pushed into adulthood.
Do you find that girls, as they turn into women, ever reach a point where they say, maybe I made a mistake about becoming a mother so young?
Yes, quite often they do in young adulthood. And even if, as they begin as those who are going to go far, and some indeed do go far, develop these skills, and then begin to get out into the world of work and see how hampered they are by having one or more children, then they may reflect on it and say that they're sorry they didn't wait, because they can now see they're out in the world, away from perhaps the community they grew up in, and they can see how they have limited their lives.
You know, the public debate about teenage pregnancy usually has to do with single teenage mothers.
Mm-hmm.
Do you find that often the teenage mother would prefer to have married the father of the baby?
I think it depends. I know that's a sort of a wishy-washy answer. Many of these young women have all of the old 1950s ideas about what they'd really like, and they'd like a husband and a house with a white picket fence and a nice yard for their children. And yes, they would have liked to marry the father. But if they're, especially if they're younger teenagers, 14, 15, and 16, that young man has moved out of their lives and has been replaced by somebody else who they now perhaps may want to have a child by. So I think that ultimately many of them would like to get married, but who will they marry? Most of the men in their life surrounding them are very marginal in terms of being able to support a family.
Is the outcome for a teenage mother usually much different if she's married than if she remains single?
Yes, if she's married, if she doesn't pay too high a price in the sense of being married to somebody who is abusive to mm-hmm. her, just in order to have the money. But in general, for those young women who are able to find a stable partner and who is a father for their children, yes, they do indeed do better. But they're not all that many of the men around them who are capable of fulfilling those roles. It's a sorry truth, but it's a truth.
You not only run a program for pregnant teenagers and teenage mothers, you've studied other programs and you've tried to reach some conclusions about why some are effective and why others are ineffective. But I think one thing you found that most programs are up against is that a lot of girls have this self-sabotaging instinct. And they make it very hard. I mean, they turn their back on opportunities. Maybe you could give us a couple of examples of that and how hard it is to have an effective intervention.
Yes. In a sense, what many people who run programs or even in schools could tell you is just when a young woman is on the brink of having an opportunity or making a really positive move in her life, many of them, in a sense, shoot themselves in the foot. I can give you an example. A young woman who we worked with got accepted in a nurse's training program, and she had just one child at that time. And she had graduated high school, or rather gotten her GED, and then she went and saw what the nurse's training program would be like and began to voice some fears about it. And the next thing you knew, she was pregnant. In a sense, she was saying, I'm not ready for this. I'm not ready to go into an environment where I'm perhaps going to be the only teenage mother and where I'm the only one who isn't going to be able to study at night. And I'm going to be in among women who are different from the women around me. One of the reasons girls sabotage themselves is think of what it takes to be different than all of the significant women in your lives. In your life, the first in your family to not have baby after baby, the first to graduate high school, to work outside of the community. For many of these girls, psychologically, it's as if they're saying to their own mothers and all the women they depend on, I'm going to be different than you. And you can put in parentheses, I'm going to be better.
Oh, so like it means you weren't good enough.
You weren't good enough for me. And when I do that, say, to my mother, I risk the loss of really the only significant female figures in my life.
I know that there are some school programs that try to show teenagers how really difficult and exhausting and time-consuming it would be to be a teenage mother. And some of these programs have dolls that require a lot of care.
Right.
Or almost like little alarm clocks that go off every few hours just to remind you that there will be a baby interrupting the regular pattern of your life if you become a mother. Or have you even heard of a program where you have to carry around an egg all day? Right. So to show that just one wrong move and you could have done something really damaging. Do you think programs like that are effective?
What I think is, let's say a program like that is in a classroom and there are 30 girls. Maybe it'll help one that was on the edge, you know, that was kind of ambivalent, and it will, and that's a little more mature and really can, you know, learn something by example. But no, I think they're a gizmo. And this field is full of gimmicks. You know, every week it's another gimmick.
The House is debating the welfare reform bill this week. And I think one of the assumptions of that bill is that if we cut benefits to teenage mothers, it would discourage other teenagers from becoming pregnant. Based on your research, your observations, what do you think?
Again, as in that classroom with 30 girls, let's say there are 30 girls. And let's say those 30 girls have already each had a baby. I think the notion of cutting welfare benefits will deter many of them from perhaps having another one right away. But it will not prevent first pregnancies. I do not believe that. Because most girls, when they're drawn to that, are in a sense very young. And they may not just be young in years, but they may be very immature. And that punishment, so to speak, that consequence, it just doesn't ring true for them. And so, no, I don't think it is going to prevent teenagers having babies. I do think it may slow down some who would have baby after baby.
Judith Music, thank you very much for talking with us.
Oh, and thank you, Terry.
Judith Music is the author of Young, Poor, and Pregnant, The Psychology of Teenage Motherhood. She's vice chair of the Ounce of Prevention Fund in Illinois. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is now available on cassette. To order, call 1-800-934-6000. That's 1-800-934-6000. The cost is $9.95 plus shipping and handling. Not all programs are available.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR. National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Thirty years ago, Fontella Bass had the hit record Rescue Me. For the past 15 years, she's been singing the music she performed as a child with her mother and grandmother, gospel music. Coming up, we talk with Fontella Bass and listen to her new recording of gospel music. Also, TV critic David Bianculli reviews the new sitcom News Radio. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. 30 years ago, Fontella Bass had the hit record Rescue Me. It rose to the top of the R&B charts and went gold. But many of her fans lost track of her after that. We're going to fill you in on her life before and after that hit record. A few years after Rescue Me, Bass left the pop music world. For a while, she sang with her then-husband Lester Bowie, the trumpet player with the avant-garde jazz group The Art Ensemble of Chicago. She performed very little while raising her family. In 1980, she returned to the music she sang with her mother and grandmother as a child, gospel music. When Fontella Bass was a girl, her mother was often on the road performing with the Clara Ward Singers and other gospel groups. Now Fontella Bass has a new solo album of gospel called No Ways Tired on the Nonesuch American Explorer label. Here's the title track.
I don't feel no ways tired. I come too far from where I started from. Nobody told me that the road would be easy, yeah. I don't believe he brought me this far to leave me.
Fontella Bass, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you, Terry.
Now, your new CD is really a return to gospel music for you. You grew up in a gospel family. Your mother and grandmother both perform?
Oh, yeah. When I was a little girl, 5, I used to play for the funeral homes in St. Louis with my grandmother, Nevada Carter, every night. Well, of course, $10 a night during those days was a lot of money, lots of money. We're talking about 50s now, early 50s, 1, 2, up until I graduated from grade school in 54. So I was sort of like an income person in the home.
What was it like for you as a young girl to be playing at funerals where people are overcome by emotion and you're providing the musical backdrop for it?
Oh, believe me. We needed the funds, and my grandmother said, "You shall go," and I went. And that was the end of story. Of course, you know, I had the funeral home director, Mr. Buddy Walton, and Mr. Ellis. They would walk me in, you know, so I couldn't see the remains, and they would sit me at the piano with the, what do you call it, thing that you fold up where you couldn't see the musician. Or my grandmother. And then after the funeral was over, you know, they walked me back out. So all I smelled was flowers.
Was it ever frightening to you
very,
to hear
very,
the amount of crying
oh,
and wailing?
Oh, very, very, very much so. That was devastating for me as a little girl. As a matter of fact, really, I don't go to funerals now. I just say goodbyes.
Oh, because of that experience early
yeah,
on?
Yeah.
Would people fuss over you because you were so young and so talented?
Oh, yeah. We had negative things from people in the church because by me being so young, a lot of the people would say, I just think it's a shame you got that child out there playing for you. And I was traveling all over Texas, Atlanta, Georgia, Memphis, you know. But that was very educational to me. And my mother thought so, too. And my grandmother thought so. But a lot of people, oh, she need to be in school or blah, blah, blah. But really, I never missed school that much. Maybe a week at the most.
So you were on the road with your family?
Oh, yes. I was on the road with my family at an early age.
Did you assume that you were given a special gift from God?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. Oh, yes. That's the only person I can give thanks to for my talents.
Growing up singing gospel, did you listen to and enjoy secular music?
Well, that was, of course, I listened to secular music, but it was not really allowed in the home. And first of all, we really didn't have a record player until I was much older and out of grade school. But we had, like, record shops that would play the music on the outside of the record store, you know, as you could walk through town and stuff like that. So, you know, coming from school every morning, you know, Laverne Baker, Ruth Brown, Mama, Treat Your Daughter Mean, Johnny Ace, Pledging My Love, all of those tunes, I remember them just like yesterday.
So if your grandmother disapproved of you listening to that, would she punish you if she found out?
No, my grandmother was a little more outward with her. She would let us have those talent shows, you know, on Saturday, you know, because she knew that we would be listening to everything and we would be doing everything, you know. And if she went to choir rehearsal, you know, we got in and played the Boogie Woogie and all of Louis Jordan's tune and Opened the Door, Richard, and Let Me In. So on Saturday, she would bring the family together because we would do our music lesson first. And then she'd say, what is that song I heard you playing the other day? What is that? I know now that she knew, but as a child, you know, I was going like, what song? What song, Granny? She say, you know that little boogie wiggy beat? She say, play that for me. Let me hear you. And oh boy. And then she say, boy, if you could just play your lesson like you play that.
Oh, I know that trick.
So that meant like sometimes 15, 20 minutes more with your music lesson because I know you have the ability to do these things. So that's what happened a lot of times. But my mother, I don't want to hear that. Take it out. No. And she's like that today.
Oh, so it's your mother who was the one who banned secular music.
Oh, yeah, my mother. She won't even sing in a place where they serve alcohol.
Did she punish you ever?
She'll punish me today. No. Sorry, Mom. Yeah, she's very, very, very strict. But a very loving person, you know, because when you come to learn our ways and you know our ways, you know how to accept them.
So were you forced to be sneaky when you were a teenager so that you could listen to what you wanted to without your mother finding out?
No, because I left at an early age. Well, I graduated from high school at 17, and 18, I was married and gone. Never been back home since.
My guest is Fontella Bass. She had the 1965 hit Rescue Me. She has a new CD of gospel music called No Ways Tired. We'll be right back. This is Fresh Air. Back with Fontella Bass. Now, I read that right after you got out of high school, you decided to join a carnival.
Oh, yeah.
How did you almost join a carnival?
With a child. And my mother came and pulled me off the train. Say, you're not taking my baby anywhere. Well, at the time, I didn't know. My girlfriends had told me, say, we were sitting in the tent, and I just thought I was just really, really grown. And they asked me, they had sent my name up for the Leon Claxton's show. That was a carnival that came out of Florida. And they said, and I didn't know it, so we were doing the audition, and I went up. I knew this one song, I Love You, Porky, Lena Simone. And they only had an organ, so I was playing organ in the church, so I got up, so they hired me. So I worked in St. Louis for 2 weeks. So then they asked me to go on the road with them. Well, you know, I wanted to go, you know. Why not? Made arrangements, you know, for me to get out. And I didn't tell my mother that I was going. You know, I was just going to sneak out of town. But my girlfriends, who are my friends today, called my mother and say, Miss Bass, Fontella is going to leave tonight on that train. See, they double-crossed me because they got lonely and they didn't want me to go. So they called my mom, and my mom came down on the train and literally pulled me out. I mean, you know, like hit you upside your head and all that stuff. I mean, she really did. And no one said a word to her. Not even Mr. Claxton. He said, goodbye, Fontella. It was nice having you.
Well, how did you feel about her coming on and embarrassing you like this?
Today, I'm glad. I'm glad she did. I think at that time I was a little green under the ear, and the things that were going on in the carnival at the time, that's why it was a carnival, some of the things that were going on. So I'm glad to this day that she did.
Take us to 1965, the year that you recorded your big hit, Rescue Me. That was also the year, I believe, that your grandmother died, in the year that you left your hometown of St. Louis. So how did you end up making Rescue Me that year?
Okay. When we wrote the song, I was working in the Regal Theater on Don't Mess Up a Good Thing, and I stopped in the Chess recording studio that morning, and Raynaud Minor, who is blind, was in the studio. And he was sitting there playing. He said, hey, I got a song here, you know. Come on, let's work together on this. We were the only two there. So we worked on the song. I said, you can do this, you can do that. And at that time, you know, like somebody play rhythm, you know, I just gave the melody lines for the song and a lot of the lyrics. And then I went on to work. When I... maybe a week later, they say, hey, we're going to do this here song. You know, the song you guys were working on? I said, great. So we all, you know, went in the studio, and they got the band, you know, and we cut Rescue Me. And I was reading in a paper during the recording, and it dropped on the floor. And I went, because I didn't want to mess up the band or stop the tape from rolling. So that's how Rescue Me got the famous in it.
So you were just filling time because you didn't know what the next lyric was?
Well, yeah, well, you know, you have formats. You know, I didn't know whether we were going to go to that or whatever. I didn't know what was coming up next. So I just went to the hum until I got the paper or the structure in front of me.
Well, let's hear Rescue Me.
Baby, can't you see that I need you?
lot of the hits from the 60s have ended up being used recently on the soundtracks of films and television commercials. Mm. What are some of the uses Rescue Me has been put to?
Well, American Express commercial, Sisters Act, Mo Better Blue, Vital Signs, Mel Gibson, Air America, Murphy Brown, The Young and the Restless.
Are you usually pleased when it shows up sometimes?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. It makes my day.
Do you get any kind of royalties for that?
Sure. Good. I sure do.
Uh-huh. So how much do you like to perform secular music now?
Well, I still do secular music in the studio and wherever. But on my job, I choose God. I choose the gospel. This is what I think I know and what I do best.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
I thank you too, Terry.
Fontella Bass has a new CD of gospel songs called No Ways Tired. This is Fresh Air. Noah Adams is with us. Noah, what's coming up on All Things Considered?
Hi, Terry. I'll be talking with Kurt Schork, the Reuters correspondent in Sarajevo, about renewed fighting in the northeast part of Bosnia, fighting apparently started by the Bosnian government troops in violation of the ceasefire. Peter Kenyon reports from Capitol Hill about the talk in the House on the welfare reform plan. Part of that plan would cut benefits for mothers under 18. President Clinton announces the formation of a new office in the Justice Department to oversee programs designed to combat violence against women. It's said to be part of a new campaign to reach out to women voters. Also, commentator Jerry Stern on the popularity of those magic eye puzzle books.
Thanks, Noah. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Tonight, NBC premieres two new sitcoms, a workplace comedy called News Radio, and a female buddy comedy called Hope and Gloria. TV critic David Bianculli offers one rave review and one warning.
The warning is about Hope and Gloria, which shows up tonight right after Frasier. NBC didn't send out preview tapes. And one of Bianculli's 10 laws of television is that if a network doesn't send out cassettes in advance, the show usually isn't worth watching when it finally shows up. On the other hand, NBC sent out two episodes of News Radio, its other new series, tonight. And no wonder. This show comes on right before Frasier, and if you love that show, which you should, make sure to tune in early to catch this one. Behind the scenes, News Radio comes from Paul Sims, one of the writer-producers of The Larry Sanders Show. It's directed by James Burrows, who directed Cheers and Taxi and episodes of The Mary Tyler Moore Show. So he clearly sees the potential of News Radio. And if you watch it, so will you. The cast is loaded with talent, but the three early standouts all come from sketch comedy shows. Dave Foley, the most baby-faced member of the Kids in the Hall, stars as Dave Nelson, the newly hired news director of New York's all-news radio station, WNYX. Andy Dick from The Ben Stiller Show plays Matthew, an overly sensitive reporter. And Phil Hartman from Saturday Night Live plays co-anchor Bill McNeil, and plays him like a smarter, more manipulative Ted Baxter. In the pilot, Dave shows up for his first day at work, only to find out he has to fire Ed, the current news director, who's played by guest star Kurt Fuller. Ed thinks that Dave is the new sports director. And while Dave tries to set the record straight, Bill bursts in.
Ed, I just heard you gave Catherine the Al Gore interview, and I have some thoughts on that, which I'd like to share with you, Kevin.
Bill, have you met Dave?
New sports guy, right? Great, I love sports, and I hear you're the best, buddy.
Where did you hear that?
I heard your audition tape. Good stuff, good pipes, clean delivery.
I didn't send in a tape.
You're from Canada, eh?
Wisconsin, actually.
Wisconsin, yeah. Cool. The Badger State, the nation's dairy land. Great country out there. Not so fast, Ed. Don't you think I should do the Al Gore interview? Because phone interviews keep me alert, and if I'm not alert, I might just start reading the news very slowly, like this.
I will see what I can do.
Thanks, buddy. I know you'll make the right decision.
In the second episode, Andy Dick, as Matthew, delivers a report updating the Amy Fisher story. We only hear the end of it. But when Matthew leaves the broadcast booth and steps into the newsroom, he never hears the end of it.
What's going on, guys?
Matthew, I think you mispronounced that guy's name a few times.
What, it's Joey Butterfly?
No, it isn't, Matthew. It's, Butterfuco. Butterfuco. What did I say? Well, Matthew, of all the possible mispronunciations of that name, you seem to have stumbled upon absolutely the worst one.
I don't know what you mean.
Think about it.
That's great stuff, and it builds from there. Stephen Root, as the station owner, is a riot. The women in the cast are sharp and funny, and even the theme song by Mike Post has the same rapid pulse and catchy energy as the rest of the show. The news from this radio report is that news radio is not to be missed.
David Bianculli is TV critic for the New York Daily News.
Matthew, I'm just glad you didn't do a story about Forrest Tucker.
I don't get it.
Think about it.
Oh, because he thinks I would say Taurus.
Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Technical direction from Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Alan Tu directed the show. I'm Cherie Gross.
Fresh Air is now available on cassette. To order, call 1-800-934-6000. That's 1-800-934-6000. The cost is $9.95 plus shipping and handling. Not all programs are available.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations. This is NPR, National Public Radio.